Cooldown, none. Current rank, bronze, 0.09%. Effect, iron. Periodically applies an additional instance of each stacking curse, disease, poison, or unholy affliction the target is suffering from. This is a curse effect. This effect cannot be cleansed while any other curse or any disease, poison, or unholy affliction is in effect. Effect, bronze, inflicts or refreshes the inescapable affliction. Inescapable, affliction, magic. Subject cannot be affected by teleport or non-damaging dimensional effects. With his afflictions ticking up, Jason turned his attention to the team. Sophie was relatively undamaged. The advantage of being an evasive-type defender, holding out against numbers, was not her strong suit, however, and her own armor was marked with the rents of bite and claw. Jason used his Feast of Absolution power to absorb the vampiric blood curse from her and stack his own healing in the process. The others holding the line were Humphrey, Neil's golem, and Stash, guarding their rear from behind the platform at the back. He was still in the shape of the massive hydra from which Jason had looted his whip. The golem was immune to the vampire's curse and didn't require Jason's attention. It had suffered enough damage to be forced into its chrysalis state, but that was not enough to let the enemy pass the now bronze rank summon. The crystalline cocoon was no longer the inert mass it had been in the past. It was now a rune-covered obelisk of crystal, rapid-firing crystal spikes into the crowd. Anything that got close was struck by crystal spears that shot out to strike a target, then remained bristling from the obelisk-like diamond pikes. Given the mass of monsters trying to push past, it had swiftly transitioned from obelisk to tall diamond echidna, covered in bloody spines. The chrysalis stage, as it turned out, was proving a better blocker than the golem had before entering it. Humphrey was standing strong against the horde, his strength and fortitude an impassable bulwark as his sword threshed the monsters before him like an apocalyptic farming implement. His armor was much stronger than Sophie's, but he had nonetheless suffered injuries as he put himself fearlessly forward. Neil's healing was on top of the injuries, but he had left the afflictions for Jason to drink up, which he did. That left Stash, who was faring the worst of all, being off the platform and essentially holding the rear alone. Neil had been helping, but the lack of the Hydra's regenerative powers was obvious, and the large size of the Hydra form made it easy to swarm. Jason drained the afflictions from Stash, then called out to him. "I'm coming in, Stash!" Stash stilled his body for a moment, not that the Hydra form was agile. Jason jumped directly onto his back, behind the five long Hydra necks, and slapped a hand onto one of them. "You have bestowed all instances of Guardian's Blessing to a party member's familiar, Velatraxa Stash." Jason made use of his bronze rank agility, the equal of any circus acrobat, and backflipped off Stash and back to the platform. His cloak didn't entangle him. He could make it incorporeal at will and have it drift right through his body to settle, shrouding his flipping form in shadow. "Is anyone recording this fight?" he asked.
"We're a little busy, Jason," Clive admonished.
"Right, yep." Jason cast a gaze over the situation around Stash. The multi-headed Hydra form was good at picking off the weaker monsters quickly, and Humphrey's griffin familiars were also working that rear side of the battle. They likewise went for the weaker ones, flying in and snatching them in their talons before carrying them into the air. While their griffin forms were powerful, and their dragon bone bodies not subject to vampiric powers, they did not risk alighting amongst the massing horde. They would peck the monster to death in the air, or carry them high enough that the subsequent drop did the job. As a result, there was a growing percentage of bronze rank and tougher iron rank monsters surrounding Stash, increasingly putting him under pressure. Jason began his intervention, throwing out quick spells at the monsters that presented the biggest threats. He didn't have a lot of afflictions on them yet, but he started with Inexorable Doom in preparation and followed up with a blood spell. Ability: Hemorrhage, Blood. Spell: Wounding, Unholy, Blood. Cost: Moderate mana. Cooldown: none. Current rank: bronze, 0.06%. Effect: iron. Inflicts or refreshes the bleeding and sacrificial victim afflictions. Effect: bronze. Inflicts the necrotoxin affliction. Bleeding, affliction, wounding, blood. Deals ongoing damage by causing or increasing blood loss. As a wounding effect, this condition absorbs and negates an amount of incoming healing, after which this affliction immediately ends. Sacrificial victim. Affliction. Unholy. Any drain attacks or blood afflictions suffered have increased effect. Necrotoxin. Affliction. Poison. Stacking. Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until poison is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Jason went through the strongest enemies, dropping the two-spell combination on each. When he was happy with his coverage, he leapt into the fray once more, wading through the monsters to support Stash. He went after the monsters he had thrown spells on, one to the next. He would hit each of them just once, laying on afflictions with his dagger before moving on. His whip he continued to thrash in the direction of the weaker enemies, using it to make space as best he could in the press of monsters. By the time he was done, so many afflictions were ticking over that his amulet accrued blessings faster than the hits he was taking could consume them. On his way back to the platform, he once again bestowed them on Stash. They would only last so long, but it was a respite for Neil's healing that was welcome in the endurance battle. Back on the platform, Jason turned back to look at the monsters held back by Stash's massive Hydra body and five snapping heads. He looked for one of the tougher, now heavily afflicted monsters and cast a spell. Instead of his usual finishes, punition or verdict, he hit it with something different. Ability, Feast of Blood, Blood. Spell, Drain, Blood. Base cost, moderate mana. Cooldown, 30 seconds. Current rank, bronze, 0.03%. Effect, iron, drain health and stamina. Only affects targets with bleeding wounds or who are suffering from the bleeding affliction. Effect, bronze, drains additional health and stamina for each instance of poison on the target. Of all of Jason's abilities, bar one, Feast of Blood had proven the most powerful against vampires, feeding on the blood magic coursing through them. After ranking up, it grew stronger from every instance of poison on the target, and Jason could layer quite a number of poisons. Necrotoxin, leech toxin, the ruination of the blood from his dagger, and the umbral snake venom from his new armor, all stackable and piling up under the effects of inexorable doom. The result, amplified by the vampiric vulnerability to blood magic, made the first monster wither and die, its empty husk falling to the ground. Even his transcendent damage finisher was not as strong against the vampiric monsters. While he waited for the cooldown, he threw out more spells, turning his attention to Sophie's side of the platform. Still an iron ranker, she was fearlessly punching above her weight. But while she had not been in as much danger as Stash, hers was the side closest to being pushed in. Jason continued throwing out spells on her side, in between using Feast of Blood as a finisher on Stash's. Jason glanced over the rest of the field. Humphrey was holding the most steady. Neil's growth spell had worn off, but Humphrey remained a powerhouse, stronger and tougher than any other member of the team. Jason asked Neil about Humphrey's mana consumption. "He's doing great," Neil said. "Very controlled. We've barely had to top him off." Despite the deadly blood-soaked porcupine, monsters were starting to accumulate on the golem's side. Jason was about to intervene when the golem erupted from its chrysalis. This time it had taken the form of three plain crystal blocks, each seeming comical and harmless as they stood on three legs apiece. It became less funny as they waddled into place to form a wall, each proving to possess the same spike power as the chrysalis form. Soon, all three were bristling with bloody spines. Jason turned his attention back to Stash, firing off another Feast of Blood spell before bestowing a third stack of blessings on the familiar. Many of the toughest enemies were now cleared off, and Stash and the Griffins could handle the rest for the moment. Jason returned to Sophie's side, where she fought, uncomplaining, even as her injuries and the pressure upon her mounted. Jason stepped forward and held up his hand to unleash his strongest trump card, the power that was unequivocally his strongest against the vampire monsters. Blood seeped out of his palm, and then leeches erupted from his hand. He swept his arm like a water cannon at a riot, scattering his swarm familiar over the crowd of monsters. Colin was a vampire-devouring machine. That whole side of the battle collapsed like wilting flowers. Jason had considered unleashing Colin from the start, but had decided that holding him for when he was needed most would be the most effective use. The monsters had largely recovered from the team's initial big hits and were ramping up the pressure, so it seemed like the moment was right to deploy his strongest weapon. "I'll cover you," Jason said, after draining Sophie's afflictions again. "Take a rest." While the frontliners had been bearing the brunt of the attacks, Clive and Belinda had been dishing out the damage, like Jason. Using her specious sorcerer power, Belinda gained the ability to use wands and staves like Clive, even though she could take advantage of his battle platform ritual, and he had also put enhancement rituals on her weapons, she was still a pale comparison. He was a rank higher, as were his legendary items. Both Belinda and Clive had been using their rune trap powers on cooldown. It was a little costly on mana, but so long as they otherwise stuck to their weapons, it was sustainable. The value of the spells, even Belinda's iron rank version, was incredible. The monsters were too packed together to move out of the way, pushing each other into maximizing the effectiveness of the small explosive area. Sophie resumed her position, and Jason once again dove into the mess of monsters, roaming about, laying afflictions. Through the voice chat, Clive warned them of a new threat.
"Flying monsters," he announced. "I think they're night shrikes."
The team looked up at the approaching creatures, winging their way over the jungle canopy and into the air above their clearing. Night shrikes were another monster they had encountered before. Their bodies were the size of a small, slender person, something between a bat and a hook-billed bird. They were bronze rank, but physically on the weak side. Their advantages lay in their flight and their special power, which they combined to make hit-and-run attacks with their sharp beaks. Floating above the team, Onslow turned his head to the new enemy, but Clive directed him to stay focused on the ground monsters.
"Jason will handle them," Clive told his familiar.
As monster ranks increased, so did the likelihood of monsters with exotic powers. In the case of the Night Shrike, they had the ability to plunge an area into magical darkness that even drained the magic from glowstones, although none were out for this daylight battle. The Shrikes would then strike using the darkness as their weapon, as their own senses were unimpeded by it. As anticipated, the Shrikes blanketed the platform in complete darkness, turning bright day into deeper than night. What the flying monsters would quickly discover, as had those of their kind who came before, was that they were not the most dangerous thing in the dark. Jason was no more impeded by the absence of light than the shrikes. Stars lit up on his cloak, shedding light that penetrated the magical power of the shrikes. The motes of light floated off his cloak, leaving it void black, as they floated up and around the platform. They concentrated on the platform itself, giving the team all the light they needed to keep fighting. Around the platform, the motes of light were softer and spread out, giving just enough illumination to turn the black void of darkness into shadowy gloom. By turning the monster's realm of absolute darkness into the realm of shadows, Jason made their kingdom his own. In a zone of ubiquitous shadow, Jason could teleport around as he wished. He shadow-jumped behind one of the shrikes, wrapping his legs around it, under its wings, and one arm around its neck. The weight-reducing power of his cloak stopped them from immediately plunging out of the sky, but the creature's flight was drastically impeded, and they started arcing sharply down. Jason ignored their predicament, ramming his dagger into the monster multiple times before jumping again. Jason proved a horrifying nemesis to the shrikes, jumping from one to the other and sending them crashing into their monster brethren below. Some were already dead when they hit the ground, the rest soon after from the hard landing and Jason's afflictions. The shrikes scattered, wings beating heavily as they climbed skyward. It didn't matter. The cover of darkness was vanishing in patches as the shrikes died in rapid succession, restoring the bright sunlight to dominance. When the final shrike died in the air, Jason found himself floating alone in the sky. Using the new gliding power of his cloak, Jason drifted his way over the team. Cloak fluttering around him, he alighted gently amongst them.
"All right," Neil acknowledged. "You might kind of make this look good."
"What do you think?" Humphrey asked Neil, refocusing his attention. "Is it time?"
"There's a lot of Jason's sin affliction around now," Neil said.
"Yeah, I think it's time. Everyone, dump your mana."
The team unleashed every high-cost ability they had.
rapidly draining their mana pools, much as they had at the beginning of the battle. Colin gathered up during that time strips of bloody cloth snaking through the battlefield to collect leeches like flypaper and drag them into a central mass that wrapped up into its humanoid form.
"Here we go," Neil said.
He activated his power, sending the team plus their summons and familiars into a dimensional space. Ability: Reaper's Redoubt. Shield. Special ability: Dimension. Recovery: Disease. Cost: Extreme Mana. Cooldown: 6 hours. Current rank: Bronze, 0.01%. Effect: Iron. Take allies into a dimensional space briefly while flooding the area with death energy, dealing disruptive force damage, necrotic damage, and inflicting creeping death on everything in the area. Effect: Bronze. Allies undergo extreme mana replenishment while in the dimensional space. Creeping death. Damage over time, disease, stacking. Inflicts ongoing necrotic damage until the disease is cleansed. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. The team emerged from the dimensional space with their mana replenished. The jungle around them had been withered by Neil's power, and most of the monsters were dead. Only a handful lingered past what was now the jungle line, having been outside the power's range. They were about to move on them when 8 figures emerged from the jungle. Unlike the monsters, these were all human. They stepped forward slowly, with none of the rush that the monsters had.
"That's them," Humphrey said, face turned steely. "Time to do what we came here for."
Chapter 51. The Boss Comes to Town. Humphrey swung his arms inward, brutally clapping his hands into either side of the cultist vampire's head. It relinquished its bite on Neil's neck, rearing back to let out an alien screech from its inhuman mouth. Its jaw unhinged in macabre mockery of the formerly human anatomy. The mouth no longer had teeth, just bare gums and a pair of hairy barbs growing awkwardly out from the roof of the mouth. They bristled, wet with saliva and Neil's blood. Humphrey gripped the vampire by the hair and smashed its head into the stone platform until the body stopped squirming. It was the last of the bizarrely warped adventurers turned inhuman minion.
"I think I got a big dose of that blood curse," Neil said, sounding woozy.
He cast a spell on himself.
"Imbue with life."
Clear green light glowed around his hand, then shot into his neck. Ability: Life Bolt. Renewal. Spell: Healing. Cost: Low mana. Cooldown: None. Current rank: Bronze, 0.11%. Effect: Iron. Delivers life energy through a projectile, giving a small burst of instantaneous healing. Damages certain targets that are inimical to life force, such as most forms of undead. Effect: Bronze. Bestows a mild, ongoing healing effect. It was Neil's bread and butter healing spell, which could also be used as a weapon against most forms of undead. For the unliving, the life force contained in healing magic was a destructive force, harming them as much as it healed the living. Vampires were an exception, the stolen life force in their bodies producing a warped facsimile of living flesh that could accept healing magic.
"Give me a second and I'll clear that curse, Neil," Jason said. "I'm a little tied up right now."
He was stuck to the platform by a blanket of sticky webbing. Gordon was cutting him loose with his 4 force beams.
"My new armor is definitely a step up," Jason said as he waited. "That resistance to adhesive effects on the old one would have been handy, though."
"It was," Sophie said. She was still using iron rank armor made primarily, as Jason's had been, of trap weaver leather. "They were spraying that webbing everywhere like giant nets. I couldn't dodge it at all."
"Clive," Belinda said, "you told us they would be easier to fight after being turned into vampires."
"And he was right," Humphrey said. "A few strange spider powers are no compensation for a full suite of bronze rank abilities."
"Their transformation was more extreme than I anticipated," Clive acknowledged. "From what I've read about blood weavers, they almost always leave intelligent victims largely intact. They recognize that a high intelligence minion is worth more than another physically powerful blood puppet."
I'm not sure high intelligence was an issue, Neil said. They joined a cult and agreed to come here.
Fair point, Clive conceded. Blood weavers can put essence users through a stronger transformation, as we saw here, but it destroys the mind. You saw the animalistic way they fought.
After creepily staring at them from the jungle line, the vampire cultists had recklessly hurled themselves into the team. Their reckless attacks led to the team putting them down in short order, although not before they penetrated the team's backline. Clive had displayed some unexpectedly solid staff fighting, combining strikes and blocks with blasts of magic. Belinda had used an escape ability, but Neil had been latched onto by one of the minions. Jason was soon cut free, and he immediately purged the team of afflictions, starting with Neil.
That was some good work with the staff, Sophie told Clive. You've been practicing with Humphrey?
I have, Clive said. He told me that I needed to train for the fight I don't want, along with the one I do. It would appear he was right.
Is it just me? Jason asked. Or was that a bit anticlimactic after all this time? We came here after the cultists, and they turn out to be just more monsters. I mean, after the whole vampire monster army thing, they were just a few more vampires.
They seemed more than threatening enough to me, Neil said, then hit himself with another life bolt spell.
I'm sorry they got past me, Sophie apologized to Neil.
As am I, Humphrey said. I don't think anyone expected that suicide rush. Jason was right, I think. After all the build-up, the cultists didn't amount to much.
We need to find where they were staying, Clive said. My guess would be somewhere in the center of the city, past the thickest jungle. That's probably where the Blood Weaver found them.
So that's where we'll probably find it, Belinda said.
It could be, Clive said. It might have run, though. I suspect it realized that we're strong enough to kill it and threw minions at us to buy time. It probably chose a handful that was strong and mobile and abandoned the area with them while we were chewing through the fodder.
We'll take a break, Humphrey said. Then we'll loot the monsters, burn the cultists, and get on to the middle of the city. We'll find where the cultists were staying before the Blood Weaver came along, and then what they were up to.
That was a huge haul, Neil said. 3 blood essences and a dark essence? If we find a mouth essence somewhere, we can recreate Jason's combination.
They were discussing the loot as they made their way through the still deserted jungle. Every monster for a wide area had either been taken over by the Blood Weaver and killed by the team, or fled to avoid that fate. They were doubling up on Shade's 3 mantis beetle forms, which excelled at cutting a path through the thick scrub. Humphrey with Jason, Neil with Clive and Sophie with Belinda.
That's not very mature, Neil, Jason said. You shouldn't make fun of people like that. It's why people like me more than you.
No, that's because you always bring sandwiches, Sophie said.
Sandwiches, Jason said haughtily, are the garnish on a prime slab of perfectly pan-seared rakish charm.
Getting that myriad essence was a big winner, Clive said. A legendary essence, and one of the better ones. We could buy the materials to rank every familiar on the team to silver and still have money left over.
I'd be happy to get mine to bronze, Belinda said. I'd also like to get closer to them.
How do you do it, Jason? You get along so well with your familiars, but mine are so alien.
Colin and Gordon aren't exactly everyday folk either, Jason said.
Then what's the secret? Belinda asked.
They're just people, Jason said. Treat them that way. Yes, they're a little odd to our sensibilities, but if it can think, it's a person. That's the same whether you're talking about a familiar or a god. Even a monster, although that's a tragic one. Imagine coming into being knowing that you have a terminal condition, and your options are get killed by an adventurer or go insane, kill a bunch of people yourself, and die.
Gods aren't people, Humphrey said.
That's a bit rude, Jason said. You'll have to atone for that one.
Gods are above people, Humphrey said.
There is no above people, Humphrey. There's just people. Give them enough power and they get a bit weird, but still people.
You seem very confident for someone who didn't believe in gods a year ago, Humphrey said.
But I believed in people. It just turns out that some of them are magic. Like us.
You do realise that people have different stations in life, right? Neil asked. A king is not the same as a pauper.
Of course not, Jason said. The king inherits a hat and a chair, where the pauper's lucky to get the hat. Better hat, though. What kind of idiot thinks a metal hat with no top is a great idea? The same guy who thinks monarchy makes sense, I guess.
How can you possibly think that gods are just people? Neil asked. You think you can just stand before a god and start mouthing off? I've been in the presence of gods. Just being near them was like standing under a waterfall.
From what I've heard, he did exactly that, Clive said. I talked to a lot of people after the last excursion into this astral space. A lot of them were talking about the gods showing up and the lunatic talking to them like they were random people off the street.
They are random people, Jason said. A bit showy, but nice enough. They like to make something of a spectacle of themselves, though.
The group all turned to stare at Jason. Humphrey had to crane his neck from where he was sitting in front of Jason on the mantis beetle to do it.
What? Jason asked.
They passed through the rest of the thick jungle without being accosted by monsters. If any were around, they were apparently smart enough to stay well clear of the adventurers responsible for getting rid of the rest. The shattered and scattered ruins buried in jungle gave way to fully intact buildings in startlingly short order. The line of demarcation was so stark that it reminded Jason of the Vane estate, where the lush gardens met the desert. The team made a direct path for the very centre of the city and the large square containing the Order of the Reapers trial tower. As they moved through the buildings, they started to notice fragments of unusual magic.
Everyone else is sensing that, right?
Belinda asked.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah?
I am.
God's damned magic, Sophie muttered. No. The team arrested their progress to investigate. The magic was weak enough that it was a curiosity rather than a threat. It was chaotic, patchy, and feeble. They found a fragment of sheared steel, jammed into a brick wall by some tremendous force. Clive took out some tools and began examining it.
I should look at more, he said as he finished up.
At his direction, the team sought out locations from which the strange, scattered magic was emanating. One was a cushion that had somehow buried itself in a wall as forcefully as the metal shard had. Another was a round indentation containing a dark crystalline powder. After examining the powder for some time, Clive rubbed some between his fingers.
This is a ground-down awakening stone, he said.
I didn't realize you could do that, Humphrey said.
You can't, Clive said. Every attempt to alter the form of an awakening stone has either done nothing or triggered it into returning to a raw magic state, rainbow smoke.
This is the result of the Reaper's power, Shade said. I can sense it because it is the same as my own power.
You know what happened here? Clive asked.
I suspect these fragments are the remnants of the tower's treasure stores. I have previously postulated that the dimensional spaces in which those stores were kept would collapse once the trials came to an end and the power controlling them was withdrawn. My guess would be a mana implosion affected by the protective measures put in place by the Order triggered an unexpectedly destructive reaction. There is likely less treasure to find than I originally intimated.
I think he's right, Clive said. The traces of astral magic on everything I've looked at are chaotic and unengineered. These fragments don't do anything except throw off some residual magic. It speaks more to an uncontrolled phenomena, like a dimensional explosion.
Is this residual magic a threat to us? Humphrey asked. It's weak here, but will there be more dangerous patches?
It's a conglomeration of random dimensional energies, Clive said, blasted into a chaotic mess and mixed with the power of a being who could, if it wanted, use that power to assassinate the universe. So, maybe?
I think we should give Clive some space, Jason said. Leave him to figure things out without having to answer any questions.
Clive flashed Jason a grateful look as Jason waved the rest of the team away.
"This will be the final ascension ceremony," Zato told Dougal. "The last of your essence abilities will be gone, but you will cross the threshold of silver rank today. You can anticipate being filled with something new and far greater."
"Thank you, Master Zato," Dougal said. "I know I came to the cult under slightly different circumstances than most, but I am profoundly grateful."
They were walking through the grounds of the ruined Vane estate, entering what had once been a small wood, but was now nothing but dead and withered trees. They reached a space where five equidistant trees stood at the points of a pentagram, with part of a magical diagram laid out between them with bricks. The trees could barely be called that anymore, stripped of their branches and bark and sculpted into wooden obelisks. Runes ran down their sides, alternately made from hammered-in steel or engraved directly into the wood and stained the rusty colour of dried blood.
"This is the place," Zato said. Timos had been waiting for them, head hidden within a voluminous ritual robe.
He held out robes for Zato and Dougal. Zato gave Dougal an encouraging smile as they slipped them on. The ritual took place with Dougal in the middle of the circle, Zato and Timos on opposite sides. On the robes of all three men, magical sigils lit up with power. There was a gathering of energy as the pair conducted an extended chant. Soon, Dougal felt a power rising up from within. The power surged through him, cleansing and changing. He crossed the threshold into silver, and impurity seeped through his pores, leaving him covered in filth. He was panting and tired, but grinning fiercely as he felt the full weight of the power now at his command. Timos stepped forward with a bottle of crystal wash, ignoring the smell. Dougal stripped off the robes and ruined clothes before cleaning himself off, the filth on his skin and the fallen-out hair sloughing away. Afterwards, Timos led him to where he had fresh clothes folded neatly in a bag. As Dougal changed, he reveled in the sensation of his new power. He could no longer sense his essences, but compared to the power he could feel in its place, it was no loss. He could even feel more potential power, hidden deep within his soul. It was laying untapped, right next to the star seed. He was gripped by a sudden sense of dread, the realization that the power inside him did not belong to him at all. As if it were germinating, he felt power swell out from the star seed. It kept coming and coming, an alien might flooding out of his own soul to fill the channels of power that months of ritual treatments had installed in his body. He went cold with fear and the absolute certainty that his soul was no longer his own. Dougal's last free thought was rage at Zato for his betrayal. He opened his mouth to yell, but was choked off as the new power initiated a sweeping change. Flesh rippled, but not with organic fluidity. It was like his flesh was comprised of tiny, tiny blocks, undergoing some kind of shift. The strange rippling swept his whole body before settling again, leaving no lingering indication of a body anything but organic. His body went limp, standing like a puppet hanging loose from a string. Dougal stood up straight. His expression was blank, his eyes plain grey orbs. He looked at the clothes half put on and finished dressing. Zato and Timos kneeled to the ground, heads bowed, as Dougal finished and looked over his body.
"Lord Builder,"
Zato greeted, not looking up.
"This vessel is adequate," said the Builder, now occupying Dougal's body. "If I use more than silver rank power, it will break down immediately. But the vessel was prepared efficiently. With care, it will last some time."
"The next vessel is already at a late stage of preparation, Lord Builder," Zato said.
"I know," the Builder said. "I am in your soul. There is nothing you can hide from me."
"No, Lord Builder."
The Builder walked over to where Zato was kneeling, head down.
"There has been a cavalcade of failures here," the Builder said. "You made the correct choice in continuing the work, but you made it out of fear. Fear of the consequences of failure."
"We did, Lord Builder,"
Zato admitted. The builder was silent for a long time. Zato could see from his feet that he hadn't moved. Timos couldn't see him at all, not daring to raise his eyes. "Your motivations are acceptable," the builder said, finally. "The consequences of failure are there to spur desirable behavior after all, which is what they have done. Stand, both of you." The cultists stood, but kept their eyes lowered. "I know all that has transpired," the builder said. "I am impressed with how the pair of you have handled dire circumstances placed upon you by the failures of others. Continuing the work instead of drawing back and regrouping was the right choice. Preparing a vessel that I might direct you now instead of waiting for a success to buffer the failures was likewise a correct choice. The intrusion of this astral space is more crucial than you realize."
"Lord Builder?"
"You had not yet been made privy to the true purpose of the astral space we are about to claim. It is one of a small number on this world that are more important than the others. The original intention was for a clockwork king to lead this expedition. In the wake of the failed summoning, the leadership here made a sequence of costly mistakes. This included raising our profile to the point that I was no longer able to move significant resources here without alerting the natives to the importance of the task now ahead of you."
"We will do what we can with what we have, Lord Builder," Zato said.
"As you have been doing. I am satisfied that you have both risen to the stations thrust upon you by the inadequacies of those that led before you."
"Thank you, Lord Builder," both men said.
"This astral space was taken from me in the past," the builder said. "The time has come to reclaim it. There are tools within that will greatly assist our work on this world."
"What would you have us do, Lord Builder?" Zato asked.
"For now, continue as you have been. First, we enter the astral space. Then we prepare to bring my world engineers here. Your remaining ritualists are mediocre, but under my direction they will be sufficient. Opening those gates will be wildly destructive, but you knew this."
"Yes, Lord Builder," Zato said. "I was told that claiming the astral space would be unusually destructive, but not why."
"It is hard to interrogate our people, but not impossible," the Builder said. "For this reason, the secret was restricted to the leadership. You will understand the full purpose soon enough."
"Thank you, Lord Builder. As you obviously know, the Rejector is already in the astral space. Once we are there, I will see to it that the Rejector is found and killed, should he still be alive on our arrival."
"No," the Builder said. "The Rejector and I have unfinished business. You will bring him to me alive."
Chapter 52. It's very complicated and you all need to go away. The five-story massive webbing was stretched between two buildings, completely blocking the street.
"I think I've spotted the Blood Weaver's nest," Neil said.
"Good eyes," Sophie said. "Maybe you should be the one scouting."
"That's a gift," Neil said.
"Has anyone else noticed Neil starting to take on some of Jason's more immodest traits?" Humphrey asked. Everyone laughed, but for an affronted Jason and an aghast Neil.
"You really think our friendly neighborhood spider monster's done a runner?" Jason asked Clive.
"This place is desolate now," Clive said. "It could be baiting us again, but into what? If it had something that could take us down, it wouldn't have wasted its army. The creature itself is silver rank, but the main source of its power is the minions it creates. It's fairly fast and fairly strong. It can use webs, obviously, and heals rapidly, especially if it has minions to feed on. Actually fighting it, though, worlds apart from the elemental tyrant we saw in the Waterfall Village."
"The danger of Bloodweavers is their minions, and the fact that failing to take one down means joining them," Humphrey said. "We've dealt with the main threat already."
"Exactly," Clive said. Once the minions are dealt with, a decent bronze rank team should have little problem. The things you have to watch for are the healing and the webs. For the webs, you just have to be careful. For the healing, you need to stop it from feeding and be able to pile on enough damage.
If that thing is in there, Humphrey said, we'll be ready. Neil, you're our first line of defense against the webs. Hold your shields for anyone with a web coming their way. As for putting on damage and taking off healing, Jason will be doing both. The rest of us are there to give them an easier job and cut loose anyone who does get webbed up.
Are we actually going in there?
Belinda asked.
We are, Humphrey said.
Won't it be all sticky? Sophie asked.
No, Clive said. Spider monsters who make webs like this can produce two kinds of silk. One is a tool and a weapon. It's sticky and dangerous, but only lasts a short time. Remember the remnants we first found in the jungle? It had degraded relatively quickly, which is no way to make a home. The other stuff is stronger and most resistant to the elements. It's also hard to build structures from a sticky substance. A nest like this is literally woven from silk. It's why many monsters who make nests like this are called weavers.
The nest turned out to be a network of wide tunnels to accommodate the blood weaver itself, which was quite large. The team didn't feel constricted as they worked their way up through the spiral tunnels that ascended throughout. The tunnels led them to chambers, some of which were unclear as to purpose, while others were unpleasantly obvious. The blood weaver's grisly larder was the most unpleasant sight Jason had encountered since the cannibal kitchen that was his introduction to the horrors his new world could hold. The team searched the entire place, finding neither monster nor treasure. When they had thoroughly explored the nest, they moved from its highest reaches to the roof of one of the buildings to which it was anchored.
I suppose this means we always need to keep an eye out, Belinda said. Not that we weren't already.
Yes, Clive agreed. It's silver rank and a stealth-type monster, so it can hide its aura from us. Makes it hard to see it coming. That said, monsters don't tend to be vengeful the way people are. They don't have pride to injure. Most likely, the blood weaver will find some far corner of the city and set itself up all over again. It's smart enough to prepare for if we find it again, and also smart enough to not seek us out.
So what do we do about it? Neil asked. Do we hunt it before it establishes itself again?
We didn't come here to kill a blood weaver, Humphrey said. It was the obstacle, not the objective.
The blood weaver can prepare all it likes. Time is not on its side. Monsters don't grow stronger, so the most it can do is collect another set of minions while we're all shooting up like rockets in this place.
What are rockets?
Sophie asked.
They're things that go up, Jason said. Really, really up. You can send people to the moon with them.
I heard about diamond rankers who teleported to the moons, Clive said. No idea if it's true. How could people get to the moon in your world if they don't have magic?
With rockets, Jason said.
How do they work?
Clive asked. Well, you know how when there's an explosion, stuff flies away?
Of course.
Clive said. It's basically that, but you need to be very careful.
It sounds like you don't really understand how it works, Neil said.
I don't know much, Jason admitted. Also, I'm pretty sure most of what I do know is wrong. Also, this may fall under stuff knowledge doesn't want me talking about. When I take a bribe, I stay bribed. That's how integrity works.
That's not how integrity works, Humphrey said. The team laughing at his exasperation. The team had felt the confrontation with the silver rank monster and her army of vampire monsters looming over them as they frenetically trained. Now the fighting was done, at least for now. The tension was draining away like a sluice gate had been opened.
What now?
Sophie asked.
The cultist camp, Clive said firmly. Our best bet now is that they were set up here, in the middle of the city, when the blood weaver either spawned or wandered in. Whatever tools they used for whatever they did should be there.
The most intact buildings were directly around the central square, Humphrey said. Unless the destruction of the tower significantly damaged them, that would be my guess for where they tried to wait out the builder's plans for this place.
I just hope the purpose for the magic going up isn't to wake up those giant golems, Neil said.
I think we can all get on board with that, Humphrey said. The first thing we'll do is head to the old tower and survey the destruction. We can reassess from there.
What about these magic fragments we've been seeing? Neil asked.
Everything I've been able to determine supports Shade's postulation, Clive said. I think they're just fragments of destroyed treasure. I wouldn't go eating them, but they shouldn't pose us any threat.
I'm not sure I want to rely on shouldn't, Neil said. Moving to the very middle of the city, it became clear that the Order of the Reaper's testing tower had self-destructed in extremely violent fashion. Huge chunks of rubble were laying in the street under the impact marks of the walls they had crashed into. When they reached the square itself, the wide tower had been replaced with a crater. The buildings around the square looked like they had been shelled. The intact facades, the team remembered, were riddled with holes. Many had collapsed entirely, exposing the interiors.
Probably not in there, Neil said.
On top of the destruction, the treasure fragments radiating magic was so thick as to be overlapping. It still presented no discernible threat, but was wearying to magic senses, like strobing rainbow lights. Leaving the buildings closest to the center behind, the team went looking for those that had retained their integrity and weren't painted in distracting magical shards. They had to be thorough and didn't want to risk splitting up, so it took a day and a half of rigorous searching before they found where the cultists had been holed up. The camp was two streets back from the central square, conveniently marked by residual webs from what was presumably the battle where the cultists had fallen prey to the Bloodweaver. The cultists had made a relatively comfortable home for themselves, with chairs, beds, even rugs. There was a large and well-stocked bookshelf, though Clive snorted derisively on browsing through it.
I think these guys shared your taste in literature, Soph, Belinda said, also perusing the tomes. It looks like there's a lot of Glistening Thighs books here.
Glistening Thighs? Neil asked.
You know, Belinda said. Lots of heaving bosoms and men who don't care what anyone thinks about them, yet still have their chests immaculately waxed.
That's quite enough, Sophie said, looking embarrassed.
She's even been thinking about writing her own.
I have not.
It's about a woman born into poor circumstances, pursued by dastardly men for her beauty, until she's rescued by a dashing man who leads her on a life of adventure.
She is completely making this up, Sophie insisted.
Jason, do you wax your chest?
Shut up, Lindy. I don't wax it, Jason said. If I did, I'd use a jewelry depilatory cream, not wax. I only ranked up the other day, though, so I'm mostly hairless right now anyway.
We really need to stop talking about this, Sophie said.
You shouldn't be ashamed of what you like to read, Jason said.
So long as you enjoy it, that's what matters.
Sophie put her face in her hands and let out a sobbing groan. Clive found what he was looking for in the basement of the building. The team had initially gone straight to the upper floor where the Bloodweaver seemed to have burst in, before searching the rest of the building more methodically.
They must have brought in this with that specialty dimensional bag we found upstairs, Clive said.
Iron rank dimensional bags had a per-item volume limit, slightly smaller than that of an iron rank personal space power. To store the huge metal plate they had found set into the floor would have required a specialty bag designed to hold that item and that item alone. It was a massive, heavy plate of solid brass. Set into it was an excruciatingly complex magical diagram in silver, along with runes and sigils made of gemstones in a variety of vibrant colours. The walls of the basement also had magical circles set into them, these ones carved directly from the brick and filled with some kind of blue-tinted plaster. These were much cruder efforts than the delicate, elegant workmanship of the plate.
"What is it?" Humphrey asked.
"I don't know,"
Clive said, lightly, reverently brushing his fingers over it. "Should you be touching it?" Jason asked. To his magical senses, the plate was even more sophisticated than its appearance suggested.
"It won't affect us," Clive said. "This is some kind of astral magic. Whatever it's doing is working directly with the astral, not affecting the physical realm at all. You could do a dance on top of it, and it wouldn't care.
These magic diagrams on the walls are from simple masking rituals, Belinda said.
You're right, Jason said. This looks exactly like I would have done when all I had was some skillbook knowledge. I'm willing to bet that one of the cultists was loaded up with enough skillbook knowledge to set up that big plate to do its thing and throw up some rituals to hide the plate's magic.
To keep passing monsters from coming to investigate, Belinda said.
Exactly, Jason said. Does that sound right, Clive?
Hmm?
Clive looked up, distracted.
What?
Does that sound right? Jason repeated.
No idea, Clive said. This is going to take me a while to figure out. Jason, take out those books on astral magic that knowledge gave you. Then you should all just go upstairs and settle in. It's very complicated and you all need to go away. I'll probably call you and Belinda down, Jason, to help me go through the books when I have a better idea of what we're dealing with. You've both got at least some training, so I should be able to get some use out of you.
You make us sound like a Christmas present from an inattentive aunt, Jason said.
What's Christmas? Clive asked.
Never mind, Jason said. He took a bookcase from his inventory, which he had purchased to store everything knowledge had given him. Just make sure you don't forget to eat again, Jason told Clive.
Did Clive come up to sleep? Humphrey asked in the morning. The cloud house was set up on the roof of the building, where it had taken the form of an extra story. It blended right in, even to the point of incorporating the stairwell that led up to the roof as the point of ingress.
No, said Belinda. Didn't you go check on him in the night, Jason?
He shooed me away, Jason said. I'm going to check on him again now.
We should all go down, Humphrey added.
Definitely not, Jason said. He made his way downstairs, where Clive had set up a table covered in open books and three chalkboards on standing frames.
Clive, go away!
A disheveled Clive came up into the cloud house and stared around at the team, wild-eyed.
You and you,
he said, pointing at Jason and Belinda.
Read this.
He shoved a piece of paper into Belinda's hand. It was smeared with chalk dust, but the penciled writing was as neat as Clive was messy. Jason stood next to Belinda, and she held it out so they could read it together. Of the team, they were the only other ones who had studied magical theory. Neil had studied some practical healing rituals, but that was the extent of it.
Well?
Clive asked Belinda and Jason.
Well what?
Jason asked.
Did you understand it?
Clive demanded.
I did,
Belinda said.
Yeah?
Jason agreed.
Explain it to me,
Clive said.
Mate, if you can't understand it, I think we might have been very wrong about us understanding it.
No,
Clive said, and let out a frustrated growl.
Of course I understand it. I wrote it. I need to make sure you understand it.
It's about astral resonance,
Belinda said. The idea is to set up a means of remote matching, Jason added.
Yes,
Clive said triumphantly.
You two, come with me. I need you to help me go through the books.
What you need, Jason said, is to get some sleep. You're looking a bit manic there, mate.
What? No, shut up. Just come with me.
Clive, Jason said, do you remember what you told me about ritual magic? To do it right, not do it fast.
Clearly, I wasn't thinking straight. You can just do it right and fast. Now come on.
Clive, Humphrey said firmly. You are going to get some sleep if I have to knock you out.
That's not really sleep,
Clive said.
Being unconscious is a different...
Then you'd best quietly take yourself to bed then, Humphrey said, because, asleep or unconscious, you're about to get laid out.
Clive snarled like an animal.
Fine,
he conceded, then turned back to Belinda and Jason.
You two, get working on those books. Anything that pertains to what's on that paper I gave you, make a note of book and page, then keep going.
Clive looked around.
Where are the bedrooms?
Neil pointed, not wanting to say anything to aggressive, sleep-addled Clive.
Not that I'm going to get any sleep, Clive muttered angrily as he walked off. My mind racing in 1,000 directions. I'll just be lying there, accomplishing nothing but a magnificent waste of time.
Moments after settling into the soft embrace of a cloud bed, he was asleep.
Chapter 53 Strong Foundations. By the time the team had spent almost a week in the camp of the former cultists, Belinda and Jason were assisting Clive almost full-time in the basement, in the room with the large magical plate set into the floor. They were digging through the text that Knowledge had given to Jason, finding anything that might be of value to Clive. They slowly gained a better idea of what it was they were looking at and how it might be useful.
"It's clear that the goddess foresaw what we would need and prepared accordingly," Clive said. "Without all this, we would have no chance of figuring out what was happening."
"And how is that going exactly?" Jason asked. "I'll admit that I've learned more than I thought possible about astral magic in the last week, but what you're looking at is way past my comprehension level."
"It's past mine," Clive said. "We're talking about principles of astral magic that go beyond anything we've managed to uncover in this world. It's like everything I learned prior to accessing these books was stone tools, and I've just discovered how to make steel."
"How long until you figure it out, then?" Belinda asked.
"Oh, I think I had it yesterday," Clive said. "I'm just trying to make sure I'm not missing something and completely wrong. Given how many new ideas I'm working with, I could have easily made a simple mistake that put my entire conception way off."
"You figured it out yesterday and didn't tell us?" Jason asked.
"I wasn't going to put forward any ideas until I was confident in them. It's been my experience that making tentative proclamations is more trouble than it's worth. People have a habit of believing the thing they like over the thing supported by the evidence, so I don't like to make statements I'm not confident in."
"That's fair," Jason said.
"There is one thing I'm certain about," Clive said. "Landemir Vane made this plate."
Jason looked down at the large plate in the floor.
"You're sure?" he asked. "That means he was working on this before any of us knew this astral space even existed."
"I'm sure," Clive said. "Ritual magic is more than cold, studious calculation. There's an artistry to it, and everyone has their own style. Even you two. Belinda's magic is bold and inventive. Yours is clever, but overcomplicated. Landemir had his own style too."
"And you knew it well enough to recognize now?" Jason asked.
"Also, what do you mean overcomplicated?" Clive chuckled.
"Jason, it's like you don't trust simple solutions."
"That sounds about right," Belinda said.
"I do recognize Landemir's style," Clive said. "He and I were the astral magic specialists at Greenstone's Magic Society. He was very reclusive and secretive about his work, for reasons that have now become rather obvious. When he required assistance, though, I was always the one he turned to. From what little I saw of his work, I could tell it was incredibly advanced, and more than once I urged him to share it with the academic community."
"I bet he loved that idea," Jason said.
"He wasn't receptive, no," Clive said. "Of course, now I understand that he wasn't as brilliantly innovative as I thought. He was good, don't get me wrong. But he was working with what the Builder cult gave him, clearly."
"It also means that he had this thing finished before I killed him," Jason said. "That was months before Emiya arrived here in Greenstone, let alone revealed the astral space. It means that the Builder cult knew about the astral space and the fact that someone was getting ready to open it up."
"All they needed was for Emiya to collect the pieces of the key and opened it up," Clive said. "For all we know, the person who commissioned him in the first place could be a Builder cultist."
"That's a scary thought," Jason said. "A diamond rank Builder cultist, having us all dance in the palm of his hand. I don't think that's what's happening, though."
"Why not?" Belinda asked.
"If the Builder cult had us over that much of a barrel," Jason said, "they wouldn't have suffered so many setbacks. They would have been much more on top of things." The team were gathered together in the lounge room of the Cloud House. Everyone was sitting except for Clive.
"It's a beacon," Clive announced. The cultists who came into this astral space with the rest of us didn't need to do much more than bring it in here and set it up. That much only took the most basic knowledge of ritual magic. All they needed was someone with basic skills to perform a series of activation rituals. Very simple, just once every few days for about a month, until the beacon locked itself into place, dimensionally speaking. After that, all the heavy magic takes place on our world.
To do what, exactly? Humphrey asked.
To create a tunnel, or a bridge, whatever you want to call it. The point is that it connects our world to this astral space, bypassing the already established entrance.
That also means bypassing its restrictions, Belinda added, including the upper limit on rank.
You're saying more cultists are coming? Neil asked.
Yes, Clive said. That's exactly what I'm saying.
When? Sophie asked.
At least a month until the tunnel is complete, Clive said. It could be 2 months or more, but definitely less than three. Now that I know what I'm looking for, I use the knowledge in Jason's books to improvise some tests, but the results are as imprecise as that suggests.
Can we leave before it opens? Neil asked. Find a way to get the regular portals back open and bring in reinforcements?
This tunnel they're building is responsible for the changes in the magical density, Clive said. It's affecting the dimensional membrane between this astral space and the deep astral. On the bright side, it means that it won't keep escalating until the astral space breaks down. Less fortunate is the fact that we can't use the regular portals until the ambient magic here reaches a new stable point. My best guess is that won't be until sometime after this tunnel has opened and closed again, and the magic has had time to settle. At that point, I can probably reconfigure the portals to the new level of magic and make them operable again.
Probably? Neil asked.
If you have a more reliable way out of here, speak up, Clive told him.
What if we destroy the plate? Sophie asked. Would that stop them from getting here?
Sadly, not, Clive said. The beacon's job was done before we ever arrived. Once they had its dimensional location on the other side, they would have been able to start working. They will have been at this for months already.
So, to summarize, Jason said, after a month or two, during which we will continue to be trapped here, an unknown force of unknown strength, but very well-known hostility, will be arriving in this astral space.
Wonderful, Neil said.
Which makes our options what exactly?
Obviously, we need to stop what they're up to, Clive said. That may be detaching the astral space from our world, or it may concern these giant golems, the world engineers. It may be both.
We don't know what forces will be coming through against us, Jason said. Hopefully, it will only be the remnants of the Builder's forces from Greenstone. Just before we left, Elspeth Arella informed me of something the interrogators got from the cultists we were finally able to capture.
That you were able to capture, you mean?
Sophie said. Which is why they were willing to keep me looped in at all, Jason said. According to the captured cultists, the local cult leadership was all but eradicated by the attack on their main outpost on that island, the one Rufus and his parents went after. From the information we have, only a couple of mid-tier leaders came through alive to take over. They may have as few as a single silver ranker left.
That's good, Humphrey said. One silver we might have a chance against.
If a gold comes through, we're done.
So what do we do?
Neil asked. Set traps?
Actually, that's not a terrible idea, Clive said. We have time, and we can be confident that they'll be checking in on those golems. I could set up some traps in those hidden doors.
Until then we train, Humphrey said. Even here, we can't hit silver rank in that time frame. What we can do is get everyone not just to bronze, but consolidated at our new rank. We need to eke out every bit of strength we can muster for what's to come.
That won't just be a goal, Clive said. That will be a necessity. From what I can tell, the magical density will be increasing at an escalating rate as the tunnel draws closer to completion.